Historic Route 66, the Pacific Coast Highway, the Blue Ridge Parkway. These are just a few of the scenic routes America has to offer. These pathways offer road trip enthusiasts quirky roadside stops and breathtaking sights as they wind through stunning landscapes, historic landmarks, tiny towns, and sprawling cities. There is nothing quite like the feeling of hitting the open road, leaving the familiar in the rearview mirror while the unknown unfolds before you. The United States is lucky to have so many scenic roadways, which bring adventure around every corner, making the journey just as thrilling as the destination. New highways completed in the early 1900s quite literally paved the way for a rise in cross-country travel. Between the 1930s and 40s, the modern American road trip took form, and people were seeing this country like never before. Hundreds and then thousands, which quickly climbed into the millions, hopped into their cars or straddled their motorbikes to see the country and all it has to offer. But answering the siren song of the great American road trip is a gamble, because not everyone is lucky enough to return from whence they came. Welcome to National Park After Dark.
As you're reading that, I realized that we've never discussed what you're going to talk about for this episode today. But from your introduction, I feel like it might be a missing person or a disappearance.
Correct.
Or something.
Yes.
Okay,
yes, yes.
Cool. Exciting.
I know. That is funny. We always kind of give each other hints and we quite literally never discuss this. So it's a surprise for everyone.
Yay. Except for you.
Except for me. Well, kind of, actually, because I researched this months ago and wrote all my notes months ago. So we're all learning today.
You're like, this is the first time I've ever heard this story.
Yeah. Past me is surprising current me with this story. And it's based, I know we've done this park before, but it's based in Rocky Mountain National Park.
Oh, so fun. We've been to Rocky Mountain, but it's been a really long time.
It has, I know. And I know, like, we really are trying to do other locations because every space has some sort of story, but some areas just have a plethora of them. So it's difficult to kind of break away. I have many books just based in this park. And I'm like, God, there are so many stories. And this one is one that was mentioned in a completely different book. It wasn't even mentioned in the Rocky Mountain books that I have. And it was just a quick blurb. So I, of course, went and did my own side tangent of research, and we have our episode today. And it was kind of inspired to be released now because of the episode we did last week with Locations Unknown and their whole vibe of missing people and disappearances. So I decided to kind of keep it in that vein and release this today. So we are going to be talking about an unsolved disappearance within Rocky Mountain National Park.
Exciting. I'm here for Rocky Mountain. I love that park. I want to explore it more. I mean, I've been there a couple times, but never stayed for an extensive period of time. And I think it's so beautiful. And I want to learn more about it and hear stories from it. So I'm excited. And it's so close to you that I feel like we have to talk about it.
I know. I love that it's like within an hour.
And we did a live show basically in the park at the Stanley, which is literally like feet outside the park. So
yeah, that was a cool moment. I loved that show, or the two shows, I guess we did.
Yeah.
Back to back.
That was a really fun night. And there's just something special about Rocky Mountain and the Stanley and Estes Park and that whole area. It's just a really cool place.
Well, I'll bring you there today, just briefly, I guess. We don't spend much time in Estes, but
that's okay. It's not technically the park.
Yeah, it's the gateway, and it's cool. I mean, anyway, okay.
It's a cool town.
Here we go. So this is actually a bit of an older case, and it takes place in the 1930s. In August of 1933, one of the road trips that I was describing in the introduction was proposed by a small family in Chicago. Solomon and Fanny Halpern, along with their son, Joseph Joe Lawrence Halpern, and his friend Sam Garrick, piled into their Ford sedan and headed west. It wasn't the full group that they were initially hoping for. Joe's brother Bernard and Joe's best friend Isidore were unable to join them, so Sam went in his brother Isidore's place. So Joe and Isidore were best friends. Isidore couldn't come, so his brother Sam went in his place. And Joe was 22 years old at this time and living with his family in Chicago. He was a University of Chicago graduate, and he was actually continuing his education and working towards the completion of his doctorate in astronomy. His doctorate thesis focused on meteors and shooting stars, and he had just wrapped up a summer's work of worth at the university's observatory in Williams Bay, Wisconsin. And this road trip would serve as a way to explore the world here on Earth instead of the world in the distant skies that he was always kind of buried in. Joe was remarkably brilliant. Math and science were his strong suits, of course, but he was also a skilled linguist. He was fluent in French and German, along with, of course, his native language of American English. And I'm not sure if he was fluent in this, but he could also read and write using the Cyrillic alphabet, which is a writing system that was developed in the 9th century for Slavic-speaking peoples.
Interesting.
So he was very, very intelligent.
Ah, I'm so jealous of people who are linguistically inclined. Yeah.
Yeah.
Linguistically inclined, because I struggle so hard.
I know. The one thing that I really wish, you know, looking back, is that I wish I leaned into language growing up. I mean, obviously, it's offered. I think the first time I took Spanish, remember, it's like, okay, take Spanish or French.
Yeah. In like seventh grade.
And that's when you pick. And of course, I picked Spanish because most of my friends were picking Spanish. Mm-hmm. Like, there was no real rhyme or reason to my choice other than that. And I just found it really, really difficult to grasp. And I never really stuck with it past the requirements. You know, like, you have to take it up into freshman or sophomore year.
You're supposed to, what they say is that it is better to learn as a young child. So to introduce it when you're a teenager is crazy. And other schools in other countries don't do that. They grow up from kindergarten on learning other languages, which makes sense. But in the United States, it's like, oh, here, learn Spanish and French when you're 13 or 14 years old and your brain doesn't care about it and doesn't absorb things as easily as they used to.
Yeah, unless you grow up with a family that speaks another language, I think for most American children, it's kind of difficult. Once that little time has kind of passed, which was the case for me. But for Joe, it was different. He was very linguistically inclined. He was really, really intelligent, and he had a bunch of different academic achievements. But despite those, Joe wasn't this like serious, studious bookworm type that you may have a picture of in your mind. He was known for his big sense of humor, his mischievous nature, and he was all around known as the ham of the family. Just kind of like,
I like that.
Yeah. I don't know. Is that something that your family uses, that term? Like a ham? Mine does.
I don't know if my family does, but I know my friends do. And I don't know. I feel like whenever I hear like a ham, I'm either thinking of a dog or
I think of a golden retriever.
Like, yeah, like I think of a big pit bull, like just a goofy pit bull, like what a ham, and just like a goofy, fun person.
Yeah.
Like what a ham.
So that's how Joe's family and friends described him. Solomon, who was Joe's father, he was a Russian immigrant, and he was on vacation from his job as an engineer at the Western Electric Company, and he initially suggested this trip for everyone. Their family had been on road trips before, but they were limited to kind of the Midwest area, the greater Chicago area, and the eastern part of the United States. So this trip going west was going to be the first for the family, and they were all really excited.
Moms are the superheroes of the world. To the moms who are raising a family and working hard in their careers, the moms who have chosen to dedicate their years to staying home and raising their kids, the solo moms holding down the fort and doing it all, no matter what your mom role is, you're amazing, and I hope you're reminded of that every day. It can't be easy managing such a busy schedule and keeping it all organized, but I have something for you that can help. The Skylight Calendar. The Skylight Calendar is a smart touchscreen calendar and organizer for all your chores, groceries, to-do lists, and a great way to manage appointments and meetings to make sure they never overlap and that they're never missed. It helps keep busy households on track and everyone on the same page so families can get time back for moments that really matter. The Skylight calendar syncs events from existing family calendars, including Google, Apple, and Outlook. You can also add events directly using the touchscreen or with the free Skylight mobile app. Updates to linked calendars will automatically appear on the Skylight calendar at your home. It's super easy to set up, and your kids will love all the emojis that you can add to it. When the calendar is not in use, you can turn it into a digital picture frame as well. The Skylight calendar comes with a 100% satisfaction guarantee. If you don't love the Skylight calendar, you'll receive a full refund. We offer a 120-day money-back guarantee and free returns. As a special, limited-time offer for our listeners, get 15% off your purchase of a Skylight calendar when you go to skylightcal.com/park. That's skylightcal.com/park. Mother's Day is coming right up, so order today to get 15% off your purchase at skylightcal.com/park.
Joe drove the entirety of the way and loved being behind the wheel of his Ford sedan as they weaved their way throughout the country, leaving Chicago behind and heading west, first to the Black Hills of South Dakota. Then they turned south, stopping at Yellowstone, before setting their sights on Rocky Mountain National Park in Colorado. Fanny, who wrote frequent postcards back to her oldest son, Bernard, at home, wrote of the mountains that they were, quote, beyond description. Just the year prior, the CCC workers completed Trail Ridge Road, making travel much easier throughout the length of Rocky Mountain National Park, making travel more convenient and offering increased accessibility to more of the park than ever before. So they're getting there right as this road is completed, and they're one of, you know, in the grand scheme of things, one of the first groups of people to really get to explore the park in this way. Through this road.
Very exciting.
And of course, like we said, we've definitely covered stories in this park before, so I won't delve into too much of the details, but Rocky Mountain is amongst my favorites, so let's give it a little love here. Roughly 60 miles north of Denver, Rocky Mountain National Park protects a 415 square mile portion of the Rocky Mountain Range that stretches from Canada to Mexico. Given national park status in 1915, visitors can explore over 100 lakes, over 350 miles of hiking trails, and one of the most scenic roads in America. 94% of the park is designated wilderness, meaning that it is protected from construction like roads or buildings or other type of infrastructure. And because of this, visitors, which number about 4.5 million every year, can explore the park on foot, bike, kayak, or horseback in true wilderness. There are over 60 peaks that reach beyond 12,000 feet in the park, which creates a large portion of tundra-like landscape within the park boundaries. Wildlife abounds here, most prominently the elk, which can be seen throughout the park, and the gateway town of Estes Park, which is where the famed Stanley Hotel is located, like we said. Mm-hmm. All in all, a perfect park for the Halperns to choose as their road trip destination. The group settled on the Glacier Basin Campground and pitched their tents. The campground offers stunning views of several peaks and glaciers within the park and was probably selected for that exact reason. Fanny, which is Joe's mother, had brought along her painting supplies and likely drew inspiration from her surroundings. And all was well for the first couple of days of their stay here at the campground. And on the third day of their trip, which was Tuesday, August 15th, Sam and Joe embarked on a hike without Mr. and Mrs. Halpern, settling on one of the most popular trailheads in the entire park, located less than 5 miles from their campground. The two men took their Ford sedan to Bear Lake Trailhead with the goal of summiting Flat Top Mountain. So this particular trailhead serves as the start point for several of the most popular trails within the park and is usually buzzing with activity, so much so that if you were to visit this trailhead today, especially during peak season, a free shuttle is offered to access the trailhead because parking is usually packed. Wow. And it's really difficult to find a spot.
Damn.
And I don't know if there's a point that's better to bring this up or not, but my mom and I actually, when we came in 2019, we took a trip to Rocky Mountain National Park together, and we parked at this trailhead, and we took this trailhead to Emerald and Dream Lakes, which is one of the most popular hikes in the park. And we went really early in the morning because of this exact thing. We were there in August, and peak season and we knew it was going to get really, really busy. So we went, literally we drove into the park when it was still dark, parked and started hiking. And it was pretty freaky because we were alone. Like we saw maybe one or two other cars in on our drive into the park. There's no one in the parking lot.
A place that's usually very busy.
So, right. There's something creepy about when it's usually packed and it's vacant is kind of...
It's like being in the city and no one's around and it's quiet. It's like...
Yeah, you're like, what is happening? but anyway, so we're hiking and my mom was freaking me the heck out because she was like, she was afraid of the mountain lions, which maybe I don't know if I put it into her mind or not. I don't know what it was, but like she was clapping and like being like, we're here and hiking and don't come near us. Like, you know, like,
fair. It's dark out and you're in mountain lion country.
Yeah. So anyway, I don't know. It was a cool hike and we reached Emerald. Was it Emerald or Dream Lake? Whatever the lake, the second lake in this hike, which I've forgotten at this point, right for sunrise. And we saw the sunrise coming over. Literally Flat Top Mountain is in the background of this lake. So I have a couple pictures and I'm like, oh my God, I've been to this area where
that's really cool.
Joe hiked. I mean, obviously in millions of other people, but it's pertinent to this story for that reason.
It's fun to have a personal story
connected to it. Yeah.
Yeah.
So the hike to Flat Top Mountain is just under 9 miles round trip and takes roughly 6 hours to complete and gains about 2,850 feet in elevation. It's considered a challenging route, but a particularly beautiful one. It passes through moraine, lakes, and pine groves, and you are rewarded with stunning views of Long's Peak, Pagoda Peak, Chief's Head Peak, and Keyboard of the Winds, which are all landmark formations in Rocky Mountain National Park. Joe and Sam reached the summit of Flat Top around 2 in the afternoon, taking in the views, and as they made their descent, they stopped near the junction of Hallett Peak to consider their next move. Joe was all for continuing on, wanting nothing more than to keep exploring the Colorado wilderness. Aside from hiking in the Black Hills on their way to this park, that was like their first stop on their road trip, Joe didn't have much outdoor experience. The two bickered briefly back and forth about what to do, Joe wanting to continue on and Sam urging them to go back to the trailhead so that they could get back to the campground sooner rather than later. After a few moments of back and forth and greeting a passing hiker, the pair landed on a compromise. Joe would go on in hopes of reaching nearby Taylor Peak, while Sam would return back to the car and wait. By the time Sam arrived back at the trailhead parking lot, it was nearing 6:30 p.m. Knowing that Joe would be at least a couple hours behind him, he settled in and kicked back for the wait. But as the hours passed and the day started bleeding into night, and hiker after hiker emerged from the tree line, there was still no sign of Joe. By 9 p.m., Sam was worried, so by 9:30, he had alerted park rangers about his concern. A group was assembled and a formal search for Joe was on the ground and combing through the nearby trails by 10 p.m. Solomon, concerned that the boys hadn't returned to the campground, made his way to Bear Lake Trailhead around this time as well, only to learn of his son's disappearance when he arrived and saw that there was a search party already out looking for his kid.
And how old is he again?
He's 22 at this time.
Okay.
By the time the search was mobilized, it was dark, which limited searchers to sticking by the trails and Joe's last known whereabouts, making their way through the forest with electric lamps, shouting his name and scanning the forest. They searched until around 3 a.m. and then resumed again at 9 a.m. the following day. As search efforts continued, remember when I said that Sam and Joe, when they were bickering, there was a hiker that passed by and they greeted them and had a short conversation?
Yeah.
So they located that hiker. And so Sam, that hiker who was unnamed, and a park ranger went to the last location that Joe was known to be at, which was at that intersection where they were having...
Where they split off.
Yeah, the back and forth of what to do. And it was here that the park ranger asked the two men to go over their statements again. Just like, tell me the story again. What happened? What did you say? Where did he go? And it was at this time that they realized the hiker gave Joe the wrong directions because they asked him which way to Taylor Peak, because that is where Joe wanted to go. So when the park ranger realized this, obviously that changes things a lot.
Yeah, like where you're going to search.
Right. So instead of pointing him to Taylor Peak, the hiker mistakenly sent him in the direction of Chief's Head Peak, considerably farther away and even higher in elevation. So now it was completely unclear which way Joe could have gone. Sam questioned if Joe would have even attempted that and wondered if he had tried to find an alternative route down, meaning that now he could be literally anywhere.
Yeah, like he realized he was going way too farther far than he meant to, and now he tried to find a different way to cut across or whatever to make it back in time.
Exactly. So over the next few days, the search expanded, covering more ground with a larger number of people. Over 150 individuals joined the effort, including park personnel, volunteers, and CCC workers. Attempts were made to get bloodhounds on the ground from the Denver Police Department, Colorado Springs Police Department, and the Colorado State Penitentiary, but none were available, restricting the efforts to horseback and on foot. I'm unsure of why there was no efforts made to search from the skies, because at this time it wasn't anything. Obviously, it's the mid-30s.
Yeah.
But there is plane.
It's an option.
There is options to search by plane, but for some reason that was not put into play here. So at this point, it's just horseback and about 150 people on foot.
Okay.
Searchers scoured the flat top area and checked all of the trail registers in the area, including on Taylor Peak and Chief's Head, but Joe's name was not marked in any of the trail registers. They set up two fly camps, which are high elevation camps that served as a food and supply station for the search members. And as the formal organized search ensued, Sam and Solomon joined in. On the fourth day of the search, Solomon wrote to his other son, Bernard, at home, who had stayed back in Chicago, and said, quote, 4 days of helpless agony and no end to it. There is slight hope that he is only lost and cannot find his way out. Let us hope so. As the days went on, the search fanned out from Joe's last known location to all possible trails between the trailhead and the campground, to the town of Grand Lake, right outside of the park, and covered all the summits in the area. Searchers worried for Joe's condition, if he was in fact still alive. Joe loved the outdoors, but, like I said, had very limited outdoor experience, and would not be described as a skilled hiker. The extent of his abilities were gained while on that road trip, during the early stops to the Black Hills and to Yellowstone. He was also grossly unprepared for any prolonged time in the wilderness. When he left the campground with Sam, he had a gray knapsack with a couple pieces of fruit, a sandwich, and a 1933 motorist guide to the park. He was wearing heavy boots, lightweight clothing, a blue and white striped shirt, and khaki slacks. Weather was pleasant during the day, but temperatures dipped into the 40s at night. Windstorms and rain also made conditions worse as the search went on.
Oof, a t-shirt with wind and rain and 40 degrees at night. I mean, that's a recipe for some serious things to go wrong.
Mm-hmm. And not having any, I mean, he had a couple pieces of fruit and a sandwich, which they also snacked on together during
the hike.
So they're
half eaten.
Right.
Yeah. And does he have water?
Not that I could see, could find.
Okay.
In the research. But it's really kind of eerie because Sam took his picture on the hike. So you can see him like leaning up against a tree in this outfit, like smiling and happy.
Yeah.
And that's the last photo that anyone has had of him because obviously it was hours before he went missing.
I will always remember the day I went out to get my first tattoo. I had wanted one for years, and I had finally turned 18, and I called my dad because one of his best friends owned a tattoo shop nearby. We made an appointment, and that day we made it a family outing, and it was just a really fun day. This was years ago, but now it serves as a really special tattoo to me because every time I look at it, I remember that day. I know tattoos can be really special for all types of reasons, and that's why it's important to take care of them and use the right products to keep them looking great. And I have the perfect product for you to do that. This podcast is sponsored by Mad Rabbit. Mad Rabbit is committed to reinventing tattoo aftercare. Founded by two friends kids with a passion for ink, Mad Rabbit creates simple, effective, and natural products that help improve and preserve tattoos, all delivered directly to your door. It doesn't matter if you've had your tattoo for years or if you just got it. Their hero product, the Tattoo Bomb, revitalizes, replenishes, and preserves tattoo ink with clean and natural ingredients for any tattoo. I have a lot of color in my tattoo, and I want those colors to really pop and not look faded, even after years of having it. Ever since I started using Mad Rabbit, I've been getting so many compliments about how good my tattoo looks. Someone even asked me when I got it done the other day, like it was something recent. Plus, with summer on the horizon, it's even more important than ever to take care of your tattoos. Mad Rabbit has all the products you need for your tattoos, from a tattoo sunscreen to a soothing gel to lotion and more. Now is the time to try Mad Rabbit. They've preserved over 3 million tattoos and they've got an exclusive offer just for National Park After Dark listeners. If you go to madrabbit.com/NPAD25 and use promo code NPAD25, you'll receive 25% off. That's 25% off when you head to madrabbit.com/NPAD25 and use our promo code NPAD25.
Searchers collected anything that they found during their search, including articles of clothing, food wrappers, any piece of litter, hoping that they could connect it to Joe, potentially. Mm-hmm. But unfortunately, nothing bridged that gap. The Rocky Mountain National Park newsletter, released on August 18th, was the first to break the news of Joe's disappearance to the public at large. From there, reports included varying and sometimes conflicting information, everything from footprints were found to he fell off a cliff or he was seriously injured to there was virtually no hope. So there's just this flurry of information coming out all of a sudden to the public and stirring up a lot of concern, obviously, but also a lot of confusing information.
And I'm sure that's hard on the family too, to be hearing rumors that your kid fell off a cliff when none of that is verified.
Right, exactly. The Park Service called off the search for Joe on August 21st, and that same day, Joe's parents and Sam left the park to make the somber return to Chicago. Shortly before leaving, Fanny wrote to Bernard, quote, "Take good care of yourself, my dear Bernard. You are all we have." And Sam wrote to his brother, saying in part, quote, "I've got some tragic news. Joe Halpern disappeared in the mountains last Tuesday, and nothing has been heard of him since. Everyone has lost hope of ever finding him alive. The last 4 days, Mr. Halpern and I averaged 15 miles of mountain climbing in our search. Yesterday, we walked and climbed 20 miles. Then a terrific wind, rain, and snowstorm with no results. It is almost impossible for anyone to remain alive for 5 nights without shelter and food in a climate so cold and stormy. The past couple of days have been miserable out here, with the deadly gloom prevailing. Mrs. Halpern cries all night long. It is my belief that Joe is not lost in the mountains, but must have seriously disabled himself."
Like he thinks he got injured somehow and he's stuck somewhere and can't come out. Even if that's kind of the worst, I think, is if you're thinking that that person can hear you or they know that a rescue team is far away, but for some reason they're injured somewhere, or in the other way, maybe they're so injured that they can't hear you or anything like that. But that's just kind of the worst, to think that they're injured and unable to do anything and you can't find them.
Yeah. I mean, and just the thought of having to leave is just heart-wrenching. I mean, I felt it's not the same because it's with a dog, but we covered the story of Jade, the dog in Yellowstone that got lost. And, you know, after an extensive search and the family having to leave, you know, and be like, they may still be out there, but we can't stay. And the search isn't going anywhere. It's so difficult to even have to imagine pulling yourself away from the person you love most.
Knowing that they're there and you've been trying, but there's a point where you have to go back for so many reasons.
Right.
Whether that's family, another kid, your job, or, you know, there's just so many things where you have to leave at some point.
Right. And that meant, you know, that doesn't mean, like we'll get into, that they gave up their efforts or hope or anything, but physically removing yourself when you just want to stay is unimaginably difficult.
Yeah.
And so how Sam outlined to his brother that it was his opinion that he must have seriously hurt himself and potentially even perished in some sort of accident, that was kind of the sentiment that most veteran park guides and rangers in the area had as well. In September of 1933, the park superintendent, Edmund Rogers, wrote to the Halperns. He detailed his and his team's thoughts about what happened to their son, and it was of their opinion that as he descended the slopes of Taylor Peak, he attempted to do so by way of the shortcut through one of the narrow vertical passages in the rock and cliff faces called chimneys. There are hundreds of these rock formations in this area, most of which are passable with climbing equipment, but of course, Joe had none of that, and he wasn't experienced in hiking, let alone climbing.
Yeah.
He went on to say that because the search was focused on that area and that hundreds and hundreds of people combed through the space shouting his name, they believe that Joe was killed in a rock slide or some sort of fall the very first night that he disappeared. And he concluded with the sentiment that they hoped that his remains would eventually be found and give the family some sort of closure.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I can kind of understand that too. It's like there's so many people in this focused area shouting his name for days and days and days. And like there's this flurry of activity in the area. If he was alive and capable and able to respond in any sort of way, he would have done that if he was alive.
Yeah.
So that's kind of the park's stance.
And they've been combing extensively.
Yeah.
Too. So I feel like that sounds accurate.
It sounds on track. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Joe is not the first and unfortunately will likely not be the last person to become lost within the park. Dozens of people ranging from children to adults, day visitors to locals, inexperienced to professional trail runners have all vanished here. Some of these individuals are found or their remains are recovered during the initial search. However, many are not discovered until many years later, sometimes many decades after they initially disappeared, when their remains are stumbled upon by other hikers or climbers or people visiting the park. According to an interview in 2018, Joe Evans, one of the park's retired chief rangers, stated that Joel Halpern is one of four documented people who have vanished and have not been found within Rocky Mountain National Park. And that was in 2018. There's been people since that have vanished. That number is really difficult to track, of course, because more people have disappeared, and conversely, others who had been missing for years have had their remains discovered. So it's always kind of, that number's kind of fluctuating a lot.
Sure, that makes sense.
For example, skeletal remains and personal effects were found in an area called Skeleton Gulch that matched those of Rudy Motor, a skier, experienced winter mountaineer, and whom served in the German army when he was visiting the area in February of 1983. Aside from his pack being found after he was initially reported missing, no sign of him was found until his remains were discovered 38 years later in 2020.
Wow, that's a really long time.
It is. I know. And, you know, like we're talking about Joe right now, obviously the center of the story, saying he's inexperienced, he doesn't have supplies, he probably doesn't know what to do. And yet, you know, Rudy Motor, he has all the experience in the world. And like this type of thing can happen to anyone given, you know, particular circumstances and accidents happen and things like that.
Yeah. Hair theory is real. The way we feel about how our hair looks changes the whole way we feel about ourselves. I've never felt more confident in myself or in my hair since I started using Pros. I have always struggled with dry, brittle, and frizzy hair, but now it's soft, it's shiny, and it feels so healthy. I used to hate it so much I would just put it up in a bun or a ponytail so I didn't have to deal with it. But now I wear it down and I'll even style it on days that I'm not running around outside in the woods, but it's all because I'm feeling so much more confident in my hair. Pros is made for people, not hair and skin types. Personalization
is rooted in everything they do, from their in-depth consultation to their made-to-order model. From millions of possible formulas, only one is uniquely yours or mine. Take my custom shampoo and conditioner and hair oil, for example. They were formulated to make my hair more manageable, nourish my previously damaged hair, and stop breakage. Pros isn't just better for you, it's better for the planet. They're a certified B Corp, cruelty-free, and the first and only carbon-neutral custom beauty brand. They even have a review and refine tool, which learns from my feedback and adjusts my formula to keep up with the seasons and changes in my life. My hair is prone to changes with each season. During the winter, I get a dry scalp easier, and now that summer is around the corner, I've changed my formula again to keep my hair extra hydrated. Pros is so confident that you'll bring out your best hair and skin that they're offering an exclusive trial offer of 50% off your first subscription order at pros.com/NPAD. So you get your free consultation, then 50% off at pros.com/NPAD. That's PROSE.com/NPAD.
So as of right now, when we're recording in April of 2024, there are 7 missing persons in Rocky Mountain National Park who have not been recovered.
Are they recent?
Some of them are.
They're like a mixture of both?
Yep, there's a mixture. So I'll give you the breakdown. Alfred Bielhartz was just 4 years old when he vanished while on a fishing trip with his large family in 1938 within the park near the Lawn Lake Trailhead. In October 1949, Colorado A&M students Bruce Gerling and David DeWitt separated from their hiking group in the same area of Flat Top Mountain. In March of 2019, Tennessee resident James Pruitt went missing in the Glacier Gorge area of the park, which is also close to the Bear Lake Trailhead. In April of 2023, El Paso County Deputy Sheriff Kevin Seifer was last seen in the park after willingly walking away from a car he was traveling in near Copeland Lake, and he remains missing. In September of 2023, seasoned outdoorsman and trail runner Chad Palanch entered the park with the intention of an epic 28-mile trek across the Continental Divide when he went missing. And Chad's family posts updates on the search efforts on their GoFundMe page, and I'll link that in the show description. He also has not been located, and of course, there's Joe. So as of right now, all those people went missing within park boundaries and have not been located. So that ranges from 1938 to 2023. Or I should say 1933, because Joe is 1933.
Yeah.
Regardless of what the park officials thought about Joe and how he disappeared and what happened to him, the Halperns couldn't help but hold out hope for their son. And how could you blame them? While they agreed that Joe could have died, they also thought that perhaps he developed some sort of amnesia after some sort of traumatic fall or head injury. When Solomon returned back to Chicago, he reported Joe missing to the police departments both in Chicago, and before he left, he reported Joe missing to the local Colorado police departments in close proximity to the park. So covering the bases, like in case he wanders out of the park, he wants
all of the... If anyone sees him in Chicago, yep. If anyone sees him in these towns, if you come across someone who seems confused, who is just in Rocky Mountain, maybe there's some ties here.
Exactly. So he does that. And then Isidore, Joe's best friend, provided his parents with letters that Joe had written him in the years prior, which gave them reason to perhaps suspect that Joe disappeared intentionally. In one of those letters, Joe alluded to becoming a transient, saying, quote, "And so I stare face out at the cruel, harsh, economically depressed world, and I'm waiting for the day when I'll be a hobo." End quote. In another, while working at the observatory, he wrote, quote, "The sun falls in the deep northwest, and soon again the stars will be free to shine on me as I harness their feeble rays for the benefit of science. Patiently I will hold them, minute after minute, hours and hours, and their impression will be preserved for the perpetual future. Enormous volumes of imperfect observations for the use of imperfect observers. Happy is the life of an astronomer. Away, far away from the banalities of man, detached in the beautiful soliloquies of comprehensiveness and unity, the mortal cares, worries, being, loves, vanish into insignificance before this formidability of nature." So basically, Isidore is suggesting that he's kind of like growing weary of life and wanting to start something new or start a different life or kind of disappear into nature. But at the same time, because his parents kind of latch onto this and they're like, well, look at what he's wrote. Like, maybe this is something he took an opportunity away from us to go off on his own and start a different life. But despite the words in his letters, Isidore was adamant that Joe wouldn't have left that way by hurting his family. Like, he wouldn't have ever.
He would have told someone.
Right.
And I think that it seems a little unlikely just because of how unprepared and how random the circumstance was. I mean, they had planned to hike together. He was with another person. It just happened that they split up. That wasn't a pre-planned thing.
You know, it's not like he was at home in Chicago, packed a bag and was like, I'm out of here, you know?
Or he was like, hey, I'm going on a hiking trip. I'll be back in a few days. And then had all these letters that said things. And people, I mean, I think about things that I've written or said, and it's like, I just want to escape the world and go live in the woods or go live off the land and not have to deal with taxes and a job. And, you know, so I feel like those are regular conversations that people have that just because of the lack of preparedness and the random opportunity that it is for him to do that, I struggle to think that that would be something that would happen.
I totally agree. And I think that it logistically and logically, it makes sense, obviously, to an outside observer. But for his parents, any hope that he perhaps is alive,
of course,
they really hung on to. And like Isidore said, he's like, he wouldn't have hurt you in this way. He wouldn't have done it this way. And despite, you know, that sting of potentially thinking that he essentially abandoned his family and kind of just struck on his own, hurt or not, they were happy to have this raft of hope to cling on to.
Yeah.
Joe's family eventually moved to a farm in LaPorte, Indiana, but were sure to keep on top of communications with the Park Service, the local police, and even the FBI, constantly writing to them asking for help in finding their son. The FBI put Joe's fingerprints, which were on file from a savings post office account that Joe had opened. For some reason, they had his fingerprints on file for
they
that.
They used to take your fingerprints if you opened a savings account. That's interesting.
They had him on file. And just in case he showed up down the line or somebody came in and the fingerprints matched up, but they informed the Halperns that they couldn't initiate an investigation as there had been no evidence of a violation of any federal law. So the FBI is like, we can keep his fingerprints on file, but we can't open any sort of formal investigation because the criteria doesn't match
what they would normally investigate.
Right. The requirements for an investigation. The Halperns' hopes continued to fluctuate with more supposed leads. In 1934, a family acquaintance who was unaware of Joe's disappearance, let alone who Joe even was at all, came to their home. When they saw a framed photo of the family, he pointed to Joe and said he recognized him. Apparently, this acquaintance said he had seen this person begging for food outside of a restaurant in Phoenix, Arizona in the winter of 1933, months after his initial disappearance. Fanny and Solomon immediately reached out to that restaurant, and the owner kindly offered to help. After sending the owner a photo of Joe, he took it to the Phoenix Police Department, who then created a poster that read the following: $50 reward for information as to the present whereabouts of Joseph L. Halpern, who disappeared in the Rocky Mountains, Colorado, August 14, 1933, was reported as last seen in Phoenix, Arizona in December 1933. Description, age 24. Okay, so he's 24. Sorry, I think I said 22 earlier. Height 5'8", hair brown, right eye crossed with a slight scar above it. Light complexion, University of Chicago graduate, proficient in French, German, mathematics, astronomy, chemistry, is a good chess player, does not smoke, usually goes without a hat. May travel under an assumed name. If located, please notify S. Halpern, LaPorte, Indiana. So the police brought this poster to several homeless encampments throughout the area because, like this acquaintance said, he was seen looking for food. So their thoughts led them to some encampments of people experiencing homelessness around the area. And some of the men claimed that Joe had, in fact, been staying there several months prior, but was going by a different name. And there was even talk of the possibility that Joe had joined the CCC, the Civilian Conservation Corps. But none of those claims, whether he was at the encampment, he went by a different name, that he joined the CCC. None of those were ever substantiated with any validity.
Okay.
In 1936, a California man named Sam Greenfield, who claimed to be an old childhood friend of Joe's, wrote to the FBI stating it was his belief that Joe was working for the Lewis Brothers Circus and was going by the name Lewis Hollenbuck. Tracking the man to a religious commune in Michigan called the House of David, he was not a match to Joe due to a difference in age. So they're like, all right, I guess we're tracking down this guy named Lewis Hollenbuck. And so they, at first, the family was like, oh, maybe he just like ran away and joined a religious movement. And it
was just hopeful.
Yeah, and obviously that was a dead end. As the nation entered World War II, Joe's father even wrote to the U.S. War Department inquiring to see if anyone with Joe's name was serving in the military. When that answer came back as a no, he then wrote to J. Edgar Hoover pleading to match Joe's fingerprints to military men in hopes that maybe they match someone who enlisted under an assumed name, writing, quote, all we want to know is that he is alive for the sake of his mother who was ill from constant worry. We appeal you to help us in locating our son. So they are doing everything that they can think of.
And this sounds like this is going on for years. Is that right?
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Time went on and the Halperns moved to Florida. In 1950, they went to probate court and filed for the legal presumption of death, but their efforts in finding him continued in the years beyond that. In 1960, Bernard, Joe's brother, raised questions as to if Sam, Joe's original hiking companion that day, knew more about his disappearance than he originally reported. A theory that some of the forest rangers presented during the initial search in 1933, but Solomon quickly squashed, perhaps as a protective measure for a family friend who was clearly distraught. So initially, the forest rangers were like, does Sam know more than he's leading on to?
Which I think is a fair question, given he was the last person to see him. Mm-hmm. Alive.
Right. But right away, the dad was like, out of the question. He's just as upset as everybody else, maybe even more so because he was the last person to see him and kind of maybe feels like this survivor's guilt or sense of responsibility for this whole entire thing. Like, if I just stayed with him, this wouldn't have happened, et cetera, et cetera. So this too, like every other theory, kind of just went nowhere. It is unclear if authorities ever questioned Sam further in regards to this big question mark, as if he had more to do with it or not. And the Halperns did not keep in contact with him in the long term. Sam Garrick went on to live most of his life in the Chicago area. He graduated from medical school, became a physician and a surgeon. He had a family. He served in the military during World War II and passed away in 1976 at the age of 64. But remember, Sam's brother Isidore was Joe's closest friend, and he kept in touch with Fanny and Solomon, even sending them over 100 letters that he exchanged with Joe in the previous years in an effort to help them uncover any potential clues that may have been hidden within the letters. He expressed how deeply he missed Joe and how often he thought of him, but was adamant that his brother had nothing to do with Joe's disappearance, and stated that sadly, it was as simple as what the park rangers originally proposed. So now it's Isidore's opinion that some sort of accident happened, and
it was just kind of
as sad and simple as that.
Yeah.
Are you that one friend in the group that loves to treat yourself? It's okay if you are. I personally splurge on myself all the time. My skincare regimen is extensive, and I will never say no to a good dessert or a fancy coffee drink, all in the name of self-care. But when it comes to treating yourself, and quite literally self-care, you shouldn't be settling when it comes to finding the right doctor for you. That's where ZocDoc can help you. ZocDoc is the place where you can find and book tens of thousands of top-tier doctors, all with verified patient reviews. ZocDoc is a free app and website where you can search and compare highly rated in-network doctors near you and instantly book appointments with them online. Once you find the doctor you want, you can book them immediately. The typical wait time to see a doctor booked on ZocDoc is between just 24 to 72 hours. That's it. You can even score same-day appointments. And the best part is that you can filter specifically for ones who take your insurance, are located near you, and treat basic basically any condition you're searching for. I've added prioritizing my health to my self-care routine, and when I need to find a doctor, I use ZocDoc to get me connected to someone I can trust. Go to ZocDoc.com/NPAD and download the ZocDoc app for free. Then find and book top-rated doctors today. That's ZocDoc.com/NPAD. ZocDoc.com/NPAD.
Solomon and Fanny Halpern passed away in the mid-1960s, and Bernard, his brother, passed away in 1998, all going to their graves not knowing what happened to Joe. However, Joe still had family that deeply cared about finding out about what happened to him. Bernard had a son named Roland, so Roland would have been Joe's nephew. Growing up, Roland didn't know much about his Uncle Joe, except for the warnings his normally stoic father would dish out about being safe in the woods. His dad would say, "Don't go hiking alone. That's what happened to my brother," and he disappeared. So, after his father's death, Roland discovered the quiet efforts he had taken in hopes of finding his brother. Tucked amongst his personal files, between the pages of books, Roland found detailed writings of his father's passion and yearning to find his brother, his frustrations about the lack of answers and dead ends, and several photos of Joe. There were also copies of letters that he had sent to the Park Service and the FBI decades after Joe's disappearance and the death of their parents. So he kind of picked up the torch from his parents and continued the constant communication, like, "Hey, don't forget about Joe. And is there any developments and what can we do?"
Never giving up.
Never giving up. Despite being born 20 years after Joe disappeared, Roland has now taken up the torch from his father, who took it from his parents after their deaths.
Oh, wow.
He has undergone the monumental task of collecting, organizing, and digitizing all of the letters, documents, maps, official reports, and correspondence regarding Joe's disappearance that his father had collected over the years, saying, quote, "He really wanted to solve this case for my grandparents before they died, and he wasn't able to do that. And I just thought, you know, wouldn't it be nice to at least know what happened?" Roland has spent years going over all of the different theories with a fresh pair of eyes, has pored over the letters and searched for any detail that was potentially overlooked or not seen during previous formal investigations in hopes of finding the missing piece that may solve the mystery of what happened to his uncle, and has worked tirelessly to verify or refute the various theories that have surfaced over time. He has filed for Freedom of Information Act requests to gain access to previously sealed documents related to Joe's case, and he has been in contact with various agencies. I'm talking the FBI, the Rocky Mountain Region of National Archives, the Park Service, the sheriff's offices around the park. Like, he has been talking to everybody. In 2009, when the National Missing and Unidentified Person System was started by the National Institute of Justice, he entered Joe. The National Park Service is listed as the contacting agency, and Joseph's identifying information, as well as a profile of familial DNA, thanks to Roland, is now on file to be matched to any unidentified remains. And Joe is actually the oldest missing persons case entered into the NAMIS system of dual databases that match missing persons and unidentified remains.
Like, in the entire system?
Yeah.
Wow.
In the summer of 2010, a few months prior to what would have been Joe's 100th birthday, Roland took his own son on a hike of the Taylor Peak area. Today, Joe would be 113 years old, if alive. Through his research, Roland discovered the cemetery that his grandparents are interred in. He contacted the cemetery in Florida and was able to purchase a nearby plot in hopes of laying Joe to rest if his remains are ever discovered. Sylvia Petum, the author of the book Cold Case Chronicles, Mysteries, Murders, and the Missing, who has a chapter dedicated to Joe Halpern's case, theorizes that perhaps Joe wanted to linger longer atop the peaks of Rocky Mountain National Park that night to watch the stars. The annual Perseid meteor shower peaks in the Northern Hemisphere every August and would have been on full display during his trip. Maybe Joe wanted to stay and watch the star show, high above the tree line in a corner of the world devoid of light pollution, a view that any astronomer would revel in. As of this recording, no trace of Joe, his remains, his clothing, or any of his belongings have ever been located. If you are in the park and happen across anything that you find suspicious here or in any other park for that matter, there's a number that you can call or text, and it goes to the National Park Service Investigative Services Bureau tip line, and that number is 888-653-0009. And that is the story of the disappearance of Joseph Halpern.
I just have to say that the story of, you said his nephew, or would have been his nephew.
It would have been his nephew. Yeah.
Going through all of those links to try and help solve this case for a person he's never met before, a person who disappeared long before he was born. That's just so kind. And I know it's his family and everything, but still to go that far out of your way for someone that you don't personally know is, it's incredible. And it sounds like he really did a lot of work to set people up if they ever do find clues for him or his remains, that they will have all that information readily available to figure out who he is.
Yep, exactly. And there had been a couple of, I didn't include it in here because there are a couple more details, but essentially, like, as you know, he was initially entered into that system, and there have been remains, like I kind of mentioned, that have been found over the years within Rocky Mountain National Park. And there was always kind of this spike of hope, like, are they Joe's, you know? And so Bernard's son, I should say, has gone through, Roland has gone through a lot, you know, just like emotional roller coaster. And obviously, like, the foundation had been laid by his grandparents, Joe's parents, and of course, Bernard, Roland's father, with all of this information. But if you have ever seen anyone try and digitize and organize boxes and boxes of documents that may or may not have any sort of organization to them, especially over so many years and moves and things like that, like, it's a monumental task.
It's not easy.
So to do that, and like you said, set up Joe and his case in a way that it's easily cross-referenced in the future, it's, like you said, it's incredible. And not everyone, a lot of people would just kind of be like, yeah, I had an uncle or a family member that went missing and we never know what happened to them. And
it's like a family story, not a family ongoing thing that you're like really care about and are trying to solve. And he even went, not only did he organize all of this stuff and digitize it, but he also bought a plot for him in the hopes that he will be found and laid to rest back with his family, which is incredible. And it's incredibly thoughtful and preparing for something that he doesn't even know is going to happen or not, which is, it's extremely kind, and it makes you feel for the family even more than you already do, because you're like, wow, there's still people right now who care about this so deeply.
Yeah, I know. And there's just like, there's something about an unsolved, you know, like we say all the time, like, humans crave closure. And we like an ending, even if it's a difficult ending, at least
you have answers.
It's solid information.
Yeah.
Right. This open-endedness and to just not know what happened. But despite all of these different offshoots of theories of everything from the circus to joining a religious commune to like different things, or going into the military under an assumed name or whatever, like, I think it is kind of a cut and dry, as difficult it is as it is, that something unfortunately happened to him. He either got lost, got injured, or whatever. I kind of look back to the case that I did of oh my God, I'm gonna forget his name. The little kid on Katahdin.
Yes.
Lost on a mountain in Maine.
Yes. Guy.
I'm so sorry. I feel like I just recorded that, even though it's been months. Anyway.
If it makes you feel any better, I cannot remember his name right now either.
Okay, great.
But I know the story.
Well, remember how that was a huge search and they thought they knew where he was going to be, but he had gone a completely different way and was way out of range.
And they weren't even searching close to him.
Right,
because he had seen that. Or he saw... Didn't he see a plane or something at some point?
He heard a plane at some point.
He heard a plane. But he never heard people yelling for him.
He never heard any of that because he had gotten lost. He went in a completely different direction than the searchers would be like, okay, logically he's going to be in this area. So I can't help but kind of think of Joe's case, and maybe that something similar happened there. Like, he just got so disoriented or lost, whether he stayed longer and lingered and was turned around at night, or he fell and injured himself. And because, well, actually, now that I think about it, the search for Joe started a few hours after he disappeared. So, but he could still get far enough away that perhaps he didn't hear them.
I also think he could have just gone in a direction where you say they searched where logically they thought he would have been, based on them having knowledge of the mountain where he went up there and had limited knowledge. He could have gotten off trail, headed in a direction that wouldn't have even made sense to someone who knew the mountain, and they might have just not searched there.
Right.
Because for them, it didn't make sense.
Right. That's what I'm thinking. And maybe he just, at that point, you know, because in the main story, I mean, that kid survived, but barely. Yeah. Barely.
He only survived because he came across a cabin and people helped him and called help.
Right. So I'm thinking, you know, yes, an accident makes sense, but they never recovered anything of his. Not to say that that's impossible, because there are so many cases that, you know, they're just a couple dozen yards off trail and you don't find their remains until much later.
But you feel like maybe they've just never actually been to the area that he disappeared to.
That's kind of like my initial thought.
I think that is a valid question or thought to.
Yeah. Especially if it's off trail and even though this area is so popular within the park, 99.9% of the people are on trail.
True.
You know what I mean? Like, yeah. If he got lost and went off trail, the chances of finding him are so slim, or even just stumbling across him. So I don't know. That's just kind of my thought.
I mean, if you think about it, when you're hiking, a few hours is plenty of time to get out of earshot of hearing people call you, or depending on where you are, maybe you could hear them, but they couldn't hear you, or, you know, like, there's just...
Yeah, there's so much. I mean, it kind of also reminds me of a story that people have been begging us to cover, which we can. But Geraldine Largay, wasn't that her name?
On the AT. Disappeared on the AT, and they found her tent very close to the trail.
So close. And I think she just went off trail to pee, right? Or to like relieve herself, and she got turned around.
I don't know the story. Yeah, she got turned around and... Yeah, and they found her remains very soon after she died, too. I think it was days.
No way.
Or don't quote me, because maybe that's not true. Because I know the story and I've read articles about it, but it's been years.
It was years later.
Really? I thought they found
her. Let's Google this before.
Or maybe there was a journal entry that was like...
Yes.
There was something where they came across.
Well, the book is called When You Find My Body, and that is an excerpt from her journal that she was keeping. And I know that we officially have to do the story on it because we're talking out of our ass about this.
Talking extensively about it.
But yeah, like, she had a journal. They think that she may have survived on her own like a month or so because she was a nurse.
Yeah.
And she had supplies.
You know more about this than I do.
Yeah. And she didn't move. She didn't move from where she was originally. She knew to stay put. And there was a search for her because her husband was waiting for her.
Yeah.
Like, there was this big search for her and she was not far off trail at all. Yeah. So it just goes to show that you think, like, sitting here in our homes, you know, in hindsight, we're like, how hard can it be? Like, how hard can it be?
Things are so much different when you're out there, though.
Right.
With elements and direction. And if you don't have a compass and you don't even know what direction you're looking at and you don't know where you are, it's just so easy to get disoriented. Even if you're close to a trail, if you don't know that you're close to a trail, how do you
it doesn't feel like you're close
to a trail, and how do you know what direction to go if you have no idea? So
yeah, and even from the searcher's perspective, you know, like, looking back on it, you know, it's probably like, God, we were so close. But again, it's so difficult. And all right, now we officially have to do that story. I'll put it on my list. I was gonna say
you have the book, so you'll have to take that one and teach me about it, because I've heard of it. I don't know the details.
I don't know all the details either, clearly.
Yeah.
But yeah, so that was Joe's case. And hopefully, you know, not only for him, but for the other individuals I outlined earlier in the episode, hopefully their remains are recovered and there is some sort of, I hate the word closure, so I won't say it, but some sort of answers for the families, because there's, in my opinion, there's nothing worse. Not only are you dealing with, in your heart of hearts, you know, they're not no longer living, which is one thing, but not being able to have any sort of answers as to their whereabouts or their final moments. That's a whole nother grief to handle. So,
and knowing, I mean, for him, it was his father who passed away, having this agony over his brother for years and years and not having those answers, and then his parents, and to still be like, I'm trying to figure this out for my family members that really cared, which I'm sure is a really big part of it. It's just, I hope that they get answers and figure out what happened or find some type of clue that gives them the answers that they're looking for.
Yeah, me too. All right, well, that's it for today. Hope everyone enjoyed learning about Joe's story, and we hope you enjoy the view.
But watch your back.
Bye, everyone.
Bye.
Thank you so much for joining us again this week. If you have a trail tale or story suggestion, send us an email at stories@npadpodcast.com. Follow us on Instagram and Facebook at National Park After Dark and on Twitter at @npadpodcast. Join our Outsiders Only community on Patreon or Apple subscriptions to listen ad-free, unlock monthly bonus episodes, and exclusive content.
And remember, when you support our sponsors, you are supporting our show. For our exclusive discount code and source information from today's episode, check out the show notes. For more information on our show, our book recommendations, merch updates, and more, visit our website at npadpodcast.com. And please rate, review, and subscribe from wherever you listen to podcasts.